17. For the second morning in a row, Winnie Foster woke early. Outside, in the ring of trees around the pond, the birds were celebrating, giving the new day a brass band's worth of greeting. Winnie freed herself from the twisted quilt and went to a window. Mist lay on the surface of the water, and the light was still pale. It looked unreal, and she felt herself unreal, waking where she had with her hair wild and her dress all crumpled. She rubbed her eyes. Through the dewy weeds below the window, a toad hopped suddenly into view, and Winnie peered at it eagerly. But no, of course it wasn't the same toad. And remembering that other toad, her toad, she thought now, almost fondly, it seemed to her that she had been away from home for weeks. Then she heard a step on the loft stairs and thought, Jessie. At once her cheeks flamed. But it was Miles. He came into the parlor, and when he saw that she was up, he smiled and whispered, Good. You're awake. Come on. You can help me catch some fish for breakfast. This time, Winnie was careful not to make a noise when she climbed into the rowboat. She made her way to her seat in the stern, and Miles handed her two old cane poles. Watch out for the hooks, he warned, and a jar of bait, pork fat cut into little pieces. A big brown night moth fluttered out from under the oar blades propped beside her on the seat and wobbled off toward nowhere through the fragrant air. And from the bank, something plopped into the water, a frog. Winnie caught just a glimpse of it as it scissored away from shore. The water was so clear that she could see tiny brown fish near the bottom flicking this way and that. Miles pushed the rowboat off and sprang in, and soon they were gliding up toward the near end of the pond where the water came in from the stream. The locks grated as the oars dipped and swung, but Miles was skillful. He rowed without a single splash. The dripping from the blades as they lifted sent rows of overlapping circles spreading silently behind them. It was very peaceful. They'll take me home today, thought Winnie. She was somehow certain of this and began to feel quite cheerful. She had been kidnapped, but nothing bad had happened, and now it was almost over. Now, remembering the visits of the night before, she smiled and found that she loved them, this most peculiar family. They were her friends, after all, and hers alone. How'd you sleep? Miles asked her. All right, she said. That's good. I'm glad. Ever been fishing before?
No,
she told him.
You'll like it. It's fun.
And he smiled at her. The mist was lifting now as the sun poked up above the trees and the water sparkled. Miles guided the rowboat near a spot where lily pads lay like upturned palms on the surface.
We'll let her drift some here, he said. There'll be trout down in those weeds and stems. Here, give me the poles and I'll bait the hooks for us.
Winnie sat watching him as he worked. His face was like Jesse's, and yet not like. It was thinner, without Jesse's rounded cheeks, and paler, and his hair was almost straight, clipped neatly below the ears. His hands were different, too. The fingers thicker, the skin scrubbed-looking, but black at the knuckles and under the nails. Winnie remembered then that he worked sometimes as a blacksmith. And indeed, his shoulders, under his threadbare shirt, were broad and muscled. He looked solid, like an oar. Whereas Jesse, well, she decided, Jesse was like water, thin and quick. Miles seemed to sense that she was watching him. He looked up from the bait jar, and his eyes, returning her gaze, were soft.
Remember I told you I had
two children? He asked. Well, one of them was a girl. I took her fishing, too. His face clouded then, and he shook his head. Her name was Anna. Lord, how sweet she was, that child. It's queer to think she'd be close to 80 now, if she's even still alive. And my son, he'd be 82. Winnie looked at his young, strong face, and after a moment she said, "Why didn't you take them to the spring and give them some of the special water?" "Well, of course, we didn't realize about the spring while we was still on the farm," said Miles. "Afterwards, I thought about going to find them. I wanted to, heaven knows. But, Winnie, how would it have been if I had? My wife was nearly 40 by then. And the children, well, what was the use? They'd have been near growed themselves. They'd have had a pa close to the same age they was. No, it'd all have been so mixed up and peculiar, it just wouldn't have worked. Then pa, he was dead set against it anyway. The fewer people know about the spring, he says, the fewer there are to tell about it. Here's your pole. Just ease the hook down in the water. You'll know when you get a bite." Winnie clutched her pole, sitting sidewise in the stern, and watched the baited hook sink slowly down. A dragonfly, a brilliant blue jewel, darted up and paused over the lily pads, then swung up and away. From the nearest bank, a bullfrog spoke. "There certainly are a lot of frogs around here," Winnie observed.
"That's so," said Miles. "They'll keep coming, too, long as the turtles stay away. Snappers, now, they'll eat a frog soon as look at him."
Winnie thought about this peril to the frogs and sighed. "It'd be nice," she said, "if nothing ever had to die."
"Well, now, I don't know," said Miles.
"If you think on it, you come to see there'd be so many creatures, including people, we'd all be squeezed in right up next to each other before long."
Winnie squinted at her fishing line and tried to picture a teeming world. "Hmm," she said. "Yes, I guess you're right." Suddenly the cane pole jerked in her hands and bent into an arch. Its tip dragged down nearly to the water's surface. Winnie held on tight to the handle, her eyes wide.
"Hey," cried Miles, "look there, you got a bite. Fresh trout for breakfast, Winnie."
But just as suddenly the pole whipped straight again and the line went slack.
"Shucks," said Miles, "it got away."
"I'm kind of glad," Winnie admitted, easing her rigid grip on the butt of the pole. "You fish, Miles. I'm not so sure I want to." And so they drifted for a little longer. The sky was blue and hard now, the last of the mist dissolved, and the sun, stepping higher above the trees, was hot on Winnie's back. The first week of August was reasserting itself after a good night's sleep. It would be another searing day. A mosquito appeared and sat down on Winnie's knee. She slapped at it absently, thinking about what Miles had said. If all the mosquitoes lived forever, and if they kept on having babies, it would be terrible. The Tucks were right. It was best if no one knew about the spring, including the mosquitoes. She would keep the secret. She looked at Miles, and then she asked him, "What will you do if you've got so much time?"
"Someday," said Miles, "I'll find a way to do something important."
Winnie nodded. That was what she wanted.
"The way I see it," Miles went on, "it's no good hiding yourself away, like Pa and lots of other people. And it's no good just thinking of your own pleasure, either.
People got to do something useful if they're going to take up space in the world.
But what will you do? Winnie persisted.
I don't know yet, said Miles. I ain't had no schooling or nothing, and that makes it harder.
Then he set his jaw and added,
I'll find a way, though. I'll locate something.
Winnie nodded. She reached out and ran her fingers across a lily pad that lay on the water beside the boat. It was warm and very dry, like a blotter, but near its center was a single drop of water, round and perfect. She touched the drop and brought her fingertip back wet, but the drop of water, though it rolled a little, remained as round and perfect as before. And then Miles caught a fish. There it flopped in the bottom of the boat, its jaw working, its gills fanning rapidly. Winnie drew up her knees and stared at it. It was beautiful and horrible, too, with gleaming rainbow-colored scales and an eye like a marble beginning to dim even as she watched it. The hook was caught in its upper lip, and suddenly Winnie wanted to weep.
Put it back, Miles, she said, her voice dry and harsh. Put it back right away.
Miles started to protest, and then, looking at her face, he picked up the trout and gently worked the barbed hook free.
All right, Winnie, he said.
He dropped the fish over the edge of the boat. It flipped its tail and disappeared under the lily pads.
Will it be all right?
Asked Winnie, feeling foolish and happy both at once.
It'll be all right, Miles assured her.
And then he said,
People got to be meat-eaters sometimes, though. It's the natural way, and that means killing things.
I know, said Winnie weakly, but still.
Yes, said Miles, I know.
18. And so there were flapjacks again for breakfast, but no one seemed to mind.
Didn't get a bite, eh?
Said May.
No, said Miles. Nothing we want her to keep.
That was true anyway. And though Winnie blushed as he said it, she was grateful that he didn't explain.
Never mind, said May. You're likely out of practice. Tomorrow, maybe.
Sure, said Miles. Tomorrow.
But it was the thought of seeing Jesse again that kept Winnie's stomach fluttering. And at last he came down from the loft, yawning and rosy, rubbing his curls, just as May was piling the plates with flapjacks.
Well, Slugabed, she said to him fondly, you come near to missing breakfast. Miles and Winnie been up for hours, out fishing and back already.
Oh, said Jesse, his eyes on Miles. Where's the fish, then? How come we got nothing but flapjacks?
No luck, said May. They wasn't biting for some reason.
Reason is, Miles don't know how to fish, said Jesse.
He grinned at Winnie, and she lowered her eyes, her heart thumping.
It don't matter, said May. We got plenty without. Come and get your plates, everybody.
They sat about in the parlor as they had the night before. The ceiling swam with bright reflections, and sunlight streamed across the dusty, chip-strewn floor. May surveyed it all and sighed contentedly.
Now this is real nice, she said, her fork poised above her plate. Everyone's sitting down together and having Winnie here. Why, it's just like a party.
That's the truth, said Jesse and Miles both together, and Winnie felt a rush of happiness.
Still, we got things to discuss, Tuck reminded them. There's the business of the horse getting stole, and we got to get Winnie home where she belongs. How are we going to do that without the horse?
After breakfast, Tuck, said May firmly.
Don't spoil a good meal with a lot of talk. We'll get to it soon enough.
So they were silent, eating, And this time, Winnie licked the syrup from her fingers without pausing to think about it first. Her fears at last night's supper seemed silly to her now. Perhaps they were crazy, but they weren't criminals. She loved them. They belonged to her.
Tuck said, "How'd you sleep, child?"
And she answered, "Just fine," and wished for a fleeting moment that she could stay with them forever in that sunny, untidy little house by the pond. Grow up with them, and perhaps, if it was true about the spring, then perhaps, when she was 17. She glanced at Jesse, where he sat on the floor, his curly head bent over his plate. Then she looked at Miles, and then her eyes went to Tuck and lingered on his sad, creased face. It occurred to her that he was the dearest of them all, though she couldn't have explained why she felt that way. However, there wasn't time to wonder, for at that moment, someone knocked at the door. It was such an alien sound, so sudden and surprising, that May dropped her fork, and everyone looked up startled.
"Who's that?" said Tuck.
"I can't imagine," whispered May. "We ain't never had callers in all the years we've been here." The knock came again.
"I'll go, Ma," said Miles.
"No, stay where you are," she said. "I'll go."
She put her plate down carefully on the floor and stood up, straightening her skirts. Then she went to the kitchen and opened the door. Winnie recognized the voice at once. It was a rich and pleasant voice, the man in the yellow suit, and he was saying,
"Good morning, Mrs. Tuck. It is Mrs. Tuck, isn't it? May I come in?"
19. The man in the yellow suit came into the sunlit parlor. He stood for a moment, looking around at them all, May and Miles and Jesse and Tuck and Winnie, too. His face was without expression, but there was something unpleasant behind it that Winnie sensed at once, something that made her instantly suspicious. And yet his voice was mild when he said,
"You're safe now, Winifred. I've come to take you home." "We was going to bring her back directly ourself," said Tuck, standing up slowly. "She ain't been in no danger."
"You're Mr. Tuck, I suppose," said the man in the yellow suit.
"I am," said Tuck formally, his back straighter than usual. "Well, you may as well sit down again. You too, Mrs. Tuck. I have a great deal to say, and very little time for saying it."
May sat down on the edge of the rocker, and Tuck sat too, but his eyes were narrowed. Jesse said uneasily,
"Who in tarnation do you think you—"
But Tuck interrupted,
"Hush, boy. Let him speak his piece."
"That's wise," said the man in the yellow suit. "I'll be as brief as possible."
He took off his hat and laid it on the mantel, and then he stood tapping his foot on the littered hearth, facing them. His face was smooth and empty.
"I was born west of here," he began, "and all the time I was growing up, my grandmother told me stories. They were wild, unbelievable stories, but I believed them. They involved a dear friend of my grandmother's who married into a very odd family, married the older of two sons, and they had two children. It was after the children were born that she began to see that the family was odd. This friend of my grandmother's, she lived with her husband for 20 years, and strange to say, He never got any older. She did, but he didn't. And neither did his mother or his father or his brother. People began to wonder about that family, and my grandmother's friend decided at last that they were witches, or worse. She left her husband and came with her children to live at my grandmother's house for a short while. Then she moved west. I don't know what became of her, but my mother still remembers playing with the children. They were all about the same age. There was a son and a daughter. "Anna," whispered Miles. May burst out, "You got no call to come and bring us pain." And Tuck added roughly, "You got something to say, you better come to the point and say it." "There, there now," said the man in the yellow suit. He spread his long, white fingers in a soothing gesture. "Hear me out. As I've told you, I was fascinated by my grandmother's stories. People who never grew older. It was fantastic. It took possession of me. I decided to devote my life to finding out if it could be true, and if so, how and why. I went to school. I went to a university. I studied philosophy, metaphysics, even a little medicine. None of it did me any good. Oh, there were ancient legends, but nothing more. I nearly gave it up. It began to seem ridiculous and a waste of time. I went home. My grandmother was very old by then. I took her a present one day, a music box. And when I gave it to her, it reminded her of something. The woman, the mother of the family that didn't grow old, she had had a music box. May's hand went to the pocket of her skirt. Her mouth opened, and then she shut it again with a snap. "That music box played a very particular tune," the man in the yellow suit went on. "My grandmother's friend and her children, Anna, was that the daughter's name? They'd heard it so often that they knew it by heart. They'd taught it to my mother during the short time they lived in the house. We talked about it then, all those years afterward, my mother, my grandmother, and I. My mother was able to remember the melody, finally. She taught it to me. That was nearly 20 years ago now, but I kept it in my head. It was a clue." The man in the yellow suit folded his arms and rocked a little. His voice was easy, almost friendly. "During those 20 years, he said, "I worked at other things, but I couldn't forget the tune or the family that didn't grow older. They haunted my dreams. So a few months ago, I left my home and I started out to look for them, following the route they were said to have taken when they left their farm. No one I asked along the way knew anything. No one had heard of them. No one recognized their name. But 2 evenings ago, I heard that music box. I heard that very tune, and it was coming from the Foster's wood. And next morning, early, I saw the family at last, taking Winifred away. I followed, and I heard their story, every word." May's face drained of color. Her mouth hung open, and Tuck said hoarsely, "What you going to do?" The man in the yellow suit smiled. "The Fosters have given me the wood," he said, "in exchange for bringing Winifred home. I was the only one who knew where she was, you see. So it was a trade. Yes, I followed you, Mrs. Tuck, and then I took your horse and went directly back.
The tension in the parlor was immense. Winnie found that she could scarcely breathe. It was true, then. Or was the man who stood there crazy, too?
Horse thief! Cried Tuck. Get to the point! What you going to do?
It's very simple, said the man in the yellow suit. And as he said this, the smoothness of his face began to loosen a little. A faint flush crept up his neck, and the pitch of his voice lifted, became a fraction higher.
Like all magnificent things, it's very simple. The wood and the spring belong to me now.
He patted his breast pocket.
I have a paper here, all signed and legal, to prove it. I'm going to sell the water, you see. You can't do that, roared Tuck. You got to be out of your mind.
The man in the yellow suit frowned.
But I'm not going to sell it to just anybody, he protested. Only to certain people. People who deserve it. And it will be very, very expensive. But who wouldn't give a fortune to live forever?
I wouldn't, said Tuck grimly.
Exactly, said the man in the yellow suit. His eyes glowed. Ignorant people like you should never have the opportunity. It should be kept for certain others, and for me. However, since it's already too late to keep you out, you may as well join me in what I'm going to do. You can show me where the spring is and help me to advertise. We'll set up demonstrations, you know, things that would be fatal to anybody else, but won't affect you in the least. I'll pay for your assistance, of course. It won't take long for the word to spread, and then you can go your way. Well, what do you say?
Jesse said dully, Freaks, you want us to be freaks in a patent medicine show. The man in the yellow suit raised his eyebrows, and a nervous petulance came into his voice.
Of course, if the idea doesn't appeal to you, he said, blinking rapidly, you needn't be in on it. I can find the spring and manage just as well without you. But it seemed the gentlemanly thing to make the offer. After all, he added, looking round at the cluttered room, it would mean you could afford to live like people again instead of pigs.
And that was when the tension burst. All four Tucks sprang to their feet at once, while Winnie, very frightened, shrank back in her chair. Tuck cried,
You're a madman! A loony! You can't let no one know about that water! Don't you see what would happen? I've given you your chance, shrilled the man in the yellow suit, and you've refused it. He seized Winnie roughly by the arm and dragged her up out of her chair. I'll take the child and be on about my business.
Tuck began to rave now, his face stretched with horror.
Madman,
he shouted. And Miles and Jesse began to shout, too. They crowded after as the man in the yellow suit dragged Winnie through the kitchen to the door.
No, she was screaming, for now at last she hated him. I won't go with you, I won't.
But he opened the door and pushed her out in front of him. His eyes were like blind fire points. His face was twisted. Then the shouting behind them stopped abruptly. And in the midst of the sudden silence came May's voice, flat and cold.
You leave that child be, she said.
Winnie stared.
May was standing just outside the doorway. She held Tuck's long-forgotten shotgun by the barrel, like a club. The man in the yellow suit smiled, a ghastly smile.
"I can't think why you're so upset. Did you really believe you could keep that water for yourselves? Your selfishness is really quite extraordinary. And worse than that, you're stupid. You could have done what I'm about to do long ago. Now it's too late. Once Winifred drinks some of the water, she'll do just as well for my demonstrations, even better. Children are much more appealing anyway, so you may as well relax. There's nothing you can do to stop me."
But he was wrong. May lifted the shotgun. Behind her, Miles gasped, "Ma, no!" But May's face was dark red.
"Not Winnie," she said between clenched teeth. "You ain't going to do a thing like that to Winnie, and you ain't going to give out the secret."
Her strong arm swung the shotgun round her head like a wheel. The man in the yellow suit jerked away, but it was too late. With a dull, cracking sound, the stock of the shotgun smashed into the back of his skull. He dropped like a tree, his face surprised, his eyes wide open. And at that very moment, riding through the pine trees, just in time to see it all, came the Tree Gap Constable.
20. Winnie was standing with her cheek pressed into Tuck's chest, her arms flung tight around him. She trembled and kept her eyes squeezed shut. She could feel Tuck's breath come and go in little gasps. It was very quiet. The Tree Gap Constable knelt over the sprawled body of the man in the yellow suit, and then he said,
"He ain't dead. Leastways, not yet."
Winnie opened her eyes a crack. She could see the shotgun lying on the grass where May had dropped it. She could see May's hands, too, hanging limp, clenching, then hanging limp again. The sun was scorching hot, and near her ear, a gnat whined. The constable stood up.
"What did you hit him for?"
he wheezed resentfully. "He was taking the child away," said May. Her voice was dull and exhausted. "He was taking the child against her will." At this, the constable exploded.
"Ding, dang it, woman! What are you trying to say? Taking that child against her will? That's what you done! You kidnapped that child!"
Winnie let go of Tuck's waist and turned around. Her trembling had stopped.
"They didn't kidnap me," she said. "I came because I wanted to."
Behind her, Tuck drew his breath in sharply.
"You wanted to?"
echoed the constable, his eyes wide with disbelief.
"You wanted to?"
"That's right," said Winnie unflinchingly. "They're my friends."
The constable stared at her. He scratched his chin, eyebrows high, and eased his own shotgun to the ground. Then he shrugged and looked down at the man in the yellow suit, who lay motionless on the grass, the blazing sun white on his face and hands. His eyes were closed now, but except for that, he looked more than ever like a marionette flung carelessly into a corner, arms and legs every which way midst tangled strings. The one glance she gave him fixed his appearance forever in Winnie's mind. She turned her eyes away quickly, looking to Tuck for relief. But Tuck was not looking back at her. Instead, he was gazing at the body on the ground, leaning forward slightly, his brows drawn down, his mouth a little open. It was as if he were entranced and,
Yes, envious, like a starving man looking through a window at a banquet. Winnie could not bear to see him like that. She reached out a hand and touched him, and it broke the spell. He blinked and took her hand, squeezing it.
"Well, anyway," said the constable at last, turning businesslike, "I got to take charge here. Get this feller into the house before he fries. I'm telling you now, if he don't make it, you're in a pickle, you people. Now, here's what we'll do. You," he said, pointing at May, "you got to come with me, you and the little girl. You got to be locked up right away. And the little girl, I got to get her home. The rest of you, you stay here with him. Look after him. I'll get back with a doctor quick as I can. Should have brought a deputy, but I didn't expect nothing like this to happen. Well, it's too late now. All right, let's get moving."
Miles said softly,
"Ma, we'll get you out right away."
"Sure, Ma," said Jesse.
"Don't worry about me none," said May, in the same exhausted voice. "I'll make out."
"Make out!" exclaimed the constable. "You people beat all. If this feller dies, you'll get the gallows. That's what you'll get, if that's what you mean by make out."
Tuck's face crumpled. "The gallows," he whispered. "Hanging?"
"That's it," said the constable. "That's the law. Now, let's get going."
Miles and Jesse lifted the man in the yellow suit and carried him carefully into the house, but Tuck stood staring, and Winnie could guess what he was thinking. The constable swung her up onto his horse and directed May to her own saddle. But Winnie kept her eyes on Tuck. His face was very pale, the creases deeper than ever, and his eyes looked blank and sunken. She heard him whisper again, "The gallows." And then Winnie said something she had never said before, but the words were words she had sometimes heard and often longed to hear. They sounded strange on her own lips and made her sit up straighter. "Mr. Tuck," she said, "don't worry. Everything's going to be all right." The constable glanced heavenward and shook his head. Then, clutching his shotgun, he climbed up behind Winnie and turned the horse toward the path.
"You first," he barked at May. "I gotta keep an eye on you. And as for you," he added grimly, speaking to Tuck, "you better hope that feller don't die on you. I'll be back soon as I can."
"Everything'll be all right," Tuck repeated slowly. May, slumped on the back of the fat old horse, did not respond. But Winnie leaned round the constable and looked back at Tuck. "You'll see," she said. And then she faced forward, sitting very straight. She was going home. But the thought of that was far from her mind. She watched the rump of the horse ahead, the swish of coarse, dusty hairs as he moved his tail. And she watched the swaying, sagging back of the woman who rode him. Up through the dim pine trees they went, the constable's breath wheezing in her ears, and emerging from the coolness and the green, Winnie saw again the wide world spread before her, shimmering with light and possibility. But the possibilities were different now. They did not point to what might happen to her, but to what she herself might keep from happening. For the only thing she could think of was the clear and terrible necessity. May Tuck must never go to the gallows. Whatever happened to the man in the yellow suit, May Tuck must not be hanged. Because if all they had said was true, then May,
Even if she were the cruelest of murderers and deserved to be put to death, May Tuck would not be able to die. 21. Winnie pulled her little rocking chair up to her bedroom window and sat down. The rocking chair had been given to her when she was very small, but she still squeezed into it sometimes when no one was looking, because the rocking made her almost remember something pleasant, something soothing, that would never quite come up to the surface of her mind. And tonight, she wanted to be soothed. The constable had brought her home. They had seized her at once, flinging the gate open and swooping down on her, her mother weeping, her father speechless, hugging her to him, her grandmother babbling with excitement. There was a painful pause when the constable told them she had gone away of her own free will, but it only lasted for a moment. They did not, would not believe it, and her grandmother said, "It was the elves. We heard them. They must have bewitched her." And so they had borne her into the house. And after she had taken the bath they insisted upon, they fed and petted her and refused, with little laughs and murmurs, to accept her answers to their questions. She had gone away with the Tucks because, well, she just wanted to. The Tucks had been very kind to her, had given her flapjacks, taken her fishing. The Tucks were good and gentle people. All this would have been swept away in any case, however, this good impression of her friends which she was trying to create when she told them what had happened to the man in the yellow suit. Had they really given him the wood in exchange for finding her? They had. Well, perhaps he wouldn't want it now. May had hit him with the shotgun. He was very sick. They received this news with mingled hope and horror, and her father said, "I suppose the wood will be ours again if that man should... that is, if he doesn't..." "You mean if he dies?" Winnie had said flatly, and they had sat back shocked. Soon after, they put her to bed with many kisses. But they peered at her anxiously over their shoulders as they tiptoed out of her bedroom, as if they sensed that she was different now from what she had been before, as if some part of her had slipped away. Well, thought Winnie, crossing her arms on the windowsill, she was different. Things had happened to her that were hers alone and had nothing to do with them. It was the first time, and no amount of telling about it could help them understand or share what she felt. It was satisfying and lonely, both at once. She rocked, gazing out at the twilight, and the soothing feeling came reliably into her bones. That feeling, it tied her to them, to her mother, her father, her grandmother, with strong threads too ancient and precious to be broken. But there were new threads now, tugging and insistent, which tied her just as firmly to the Tucks. Winnie watched the sky slide into blackness over the wood outside her window. There was not the least hint of a breeze to soften the heavy August night. And then, over the treetops, on the faraway horizon, there was a flash of white, heat lightning. Again and again it throbbed without a sound. It was like pain, she thought. And suddenly she longed for a thunderstorm. She cradled her head in her arms and closed her eyes. At once the image of the man in the yellow suit rose up. She could see him again, sprawled motionless on the sun-blanched grass. "He can't die," she whispered, thinking of May. "He mustn't." And then she considered his plans for the water in the spring, and Tuck's voice saying, "They'd all come running like pigs to slops." And she found herself thinking, "If it's true about the spring, then he has to die. He must. And that's why she did it." Then she heard hoofbeats on the road below, a horse hurrying into the village, and not long after, there were footsteps and a knocking on the door. Winnie crept out of her room and crouched in the shadows at the top of the stairs. It was the constable. She heard him saying,
"So that's that, Mr. Foster. We can't press no kidnapping charges, since your little girl claims there wasn't no kidnapping. But it don't matter now anyway. The doc just got back a few minutes ago. That feller, the one you sold your land to, he's dead."
There was a pause, and the murmur of other voices. Then a match striking, the acrid smell of fresh cigar smoke.
"Yep, she got him a good one, all right. He never even come to. So it's an open and shut case, since I seen her do it, eyewitness, no question about it. They'll hang her for sure."
Winnie went back to her room and climbed into bed. She lay in the dark, propped up on the pillows, and stared at the lighter square of her window, at the heat lightning throbbing. It was like pain, she thought again, a dull pain on the fringes of the sky. May had killed the man in the yellow suit, and she had meant to kill him. Winnie had killed a wasp once, in fear and anger, just in time to spare herself a stinging. She had slammed at the wasp with a heavy book and killed it. And then, seeing its body broken, the thin wings stilled, she had wished it were alive again. She had wept for that wasp. Was May weeping now for the man in the yellow suit? In spite of her wish to spare the world, did she wish he were alive again? There was no way of knowing. But May had done what she thought she had to do. Winnie closed her eyes to shut out the silent pulsing of the lightning. Now she would have to do something. She had no idea what, but something. May Tuck must not go to the gallows. 22. Next morning, Winnie went out to the fence directly after breakfast. It was the hottest day yet, so heavy that the slightest exertion brought on a flood of perspiration and exhaustion in the joints. 2 days before, they would have insisted that she stay indoors, but now, this morning, they were careful with her, a little gingerly, as if she were an egg. She had said, "I'm going outside now," and they had said, "All right, but come in if it gets too hot, won't you, dear?" And she had answered, "Yes." The earth, where it was worn bald under the gate, was cracked and hard as rock, a lifeless tan color. And the road was an aisle of brilliant velvet dust. Winnie leaned against the fence, her hands gripping the warm metal of the bars, and thought about May behind another set of bars in the jailhouse. And then, lifting her head, she saw the toad. It was squatting where she had seen it first, across the road. "Hello," she said, very glad to see it. The toad did not so much as flick a muscle or blink an eye. It looked dried out today, parched. "It's thirsty," said Winnie to herself. No wonder on a day like this. She left the fence and went back into the cottage. "Granny, can I have some water in a dish? There's a toad out front that looks as if he's just about to die of thirst."
"A toad?" said her grandmother, wrinkling her nose in disgust. "Nasty things, toads."
"Not this one," said Winnie. "This one is always out there, and I like him. Can I give him a drink of water?"
"Toads don't drink water, Winifred. It wouldn't do him any good."
"They don't drink water at all?"
"No. They take it in through their skins, like a sponge, when it rains."
"But it hasn't rained forever," said Winnie, alarmed. "I could sprinkle some water on him, couldn't I? That would help, wouldn't it?"
"Well,
I suppose so, said her grandmother. Where is he? In the yard?
No, said Winnie. He's across the road.
I'll come with you then. I don't want you leaving the yard alone.
But when they came out to the fence, Winnie, balancing a small bowl of water with enormous care, the toad was gone.
Well, he must be all right, said her grandmother, if he could hop off.
With mingled disappointment and relief, Winnie tipped the water onto the cracked earth at the gate. It was sucked in immediately, and the wet brown stain it left behind paled and vanished almost as quickly.
I never saw such heat in all my life, said Winnie's grandmother, dabbing uselessly at her neck with a handkerchief. Don't stay out here much longer.
I won't, said Winnie, and was left alone once more. She sat down on the grass and sighed. May. What could she do to set May free? She closed her eyes against the glaring light and watched a little dizzily as brilliant patterns of red and orange danced inside her eyelids. And then, miraculously, Jesse was there, crouching just on the other side of the fence. Winnie, he hissed, you sleeping? Oh, Jesse! Her eyes flew open, and she reached through the fence to grasp his hand. I'm so glad to see you. What can we do? We have to get her out. Miles got a plan, but I don't see how it can work, said Jesse, speaking quickly, his voice almost a whisper. He knows a lot about carpentering. He says he can take Ma's window frame right straight out of the wall, bars and all, and she can climb through. We're going to try it tonight when it gets dark. Only trouble is, that constable keeps watching her every minute. He's so darn proud of having a prisoner in that new jail of his. We've been down to see her. She's all right. But even if she can climb through the window, he'll come after her soon's he sees she's gone. Seems to me he'll notice right off. That don't give us much time to get away. But we got to try it. There ain't no other way. Anyhow, I come to say goodbye. We won't be able to come back here for a long, long time, Winnie, if we get away. I mean, they'll be looking for Ma. Winnie, listen, I won't see you again, not for ages. Look now, here's a bottle of water from the spring. You keep it. And then, no matter where you are, when you're 17, Winnie, you can drink it, and then come find us. We'll leave directions somehow. Winnie, please say you will. He pressed the little bottle into her hands, and Winnie took it, closing her fingers over it. Jesse, wait, she whispered breathlessly, for all at once she had the answer. I can help. When your mother climbs out the window, I'll climb in and take her place. I can wrap myself up in her blanket, and when the constable looks in, he won't be able to tell the difference, not in the dark. I can hump up and look a lot bigger. Miles can even put the window back. That would give you time to get away. You'd have at least till morning. Jesse squinted at her, and then he said, Yep, you know, it might work. It might just make the difference. But I don't know if Pa's going to want you taking any risk. I mean, what'll they say to you after when they find out? I don't know, said Winnie, but it doesn't matter. Tell your father I want to help. I have to help. If it wasn't for me, there wouldn't have been any trouble in the first place. Tell him I have to. Well, all right. Can you get out after dark? Yes, said Winnie. Then, at midnight, Winnie, I'll be waiting for you right here at midnight.
Winifred? An anxious voice called from the cottage. Who's that you're talking to?
Winnie stood up and turned to answer.
It's just a boy, Granny. I'll be in a minute.
When she turned around again, Jessie was gone. Winnie clutched the little bottle in her hands and tried to control the rising excitement that made her breath catch. At midnight, she would make a difference in the world. 23. It was the longest day, mindlessly hot, unspeakably hot, too hot to move or even think. The countryside, the village of Tree Gap, the wood, all lay defeated. Nothing stirred. The sun was a ponderous circle without edges, a roar without a sound, a blazing glare so thorough and remorseless that even in the Fosters' parlor, with curtains drawn, it seemed an actual presence. You could not shut it out. Winnie's mother and grandmother sat plaintive all afternoon in the parlor, fanning themselves and sipping lemonade, their hair unsettled and their knees loose. It was totally unlike them, this lapse from gentility, and it made them much more interesting. But Winnie didn't stay with them. Instead, she took her own brimming glass to her room and sat in her little rocker by the window. Once she had hidden Jessie's bottle in a bureau drawer, there was nothing to do but wait. In the hall outside her room, the grandfather's clock ticked deliberately, unimpressed with anyone's impatience. And Winnie found herself rocking to its rhythm, forward, back, forward, back, tick, tock, tick, tock. She tried to read, but it was so quiet that she could not concentrate, and so she was glad when at last it was time for supper. It was something to do, though none of them could manage more than a nibble. But later, when Winnie went out again to the fence, she saw that the sky was changing. It was not so much clouding up as thickening, somehow, from every direction at once. The blank blue gone to haze. And then, as the sun sank reluctantly behind the treetops, the haze hardened to a brilliant brownish yellow. In the wood, the leaves turned underside up, giving the trees a silvery cast. The air was noticeably heavier. It pressed on Winnie's chest and made her breathing difficult. She turned and went back into the cottage. "It's going to rain, I think," she told the prostrate group in the parlor, and the news was received with little moans of gratitude. Everyone went to bed early, closing windows firmly on their way. For outside, though it was almost dark, shreds of the hard brown yellow light lingered on the rims of things, and there was a wind beginning, small gusts that rattled the fence gate and set the trees to rustling. The smell of rain hung sweet in the air.
"What a week this has been," said Winnie's grandmother. "Well, thank the Lord, it's almost over."
And Winnie thought to herself, "Yes, it's almost over." There were 3 hours to wait before midnight, and nothing whatever to do. Winnie wandered restlessly about her room, sat in her rocker, lay on her bed, counted the ticks of the hall clock. Beneath her excitement, she was thick with guilt. For the second time in 3 short days, though they seemed many more than that, she was about to do something which she knew would be forbidden. She didn't have to ask. Winnie had her own strong sense of rightness. She knew that she could always say afterward, "Well, you never told me not to," but how silly that would be. Of course, it would never occur to them to include such a thing on their list of don'ts. She could hear them saying it and almost smiled. "Now, remember, Winifred, don't bite your fingernails, don't interrupt when someone else is speaking, and don't go down to the jailhouse at midnight to change places with prisoners." Still, it wasn't really funny. What would happen in the morning when the constable found her in the cell and had to bring her home for the second time? What would they say? Would they ever trust her again? Winnie squirmed, sitting in the rocker, and swallowed uncomfortably. Well, she would have to make them understand somehow without explaining. The hall clock chimed 11. Outside, the wind had stopped. Everything, it seemed, was waiting. Winnie lay down and closed her eyes, thinking of Tuck and May, of Miles and Jesse. Her heart softened. They needed her to take care of them, for in the funny sort of way that had struck her at the first, they were helpless or too trusting. Well, something like that. Anyway, they needed her. She would not disappoint them. May would go free. No one would have to find out. Winnie would not have to find out that May could not, but Winnie blocked the picture from her mind, the horror that would prove the secret. Instead, she turned her thoughts to Jesse. When she was 17, would she? If it was true, would she? And if she did, would she be sorry afterwards? Tuck had said, "It's something you don't find out how you feel until afterwards." But no, it wasn't true. She knew that now, here in her own bedroom. They were probably crazy after all. But she loved them anyway. They needed her. And thinking this, Winnie fell asleep. She woke with a jerk some time later and sat up alarmed. The clock was ticking steadily. The darkness was complete. Outside, the night seemed poised on tiptoe, waiting, waiting, holding its breath for the storm. Winnie stole out to the hall and frowned at the clock face in the shadows. And at last, she could make it out, for the black Roman numerals were just barely visible against their white ground. The brass hands glowed faintly. As she peered at them, the long hands snapped forward one more notch with a loud click. She had not missed her moment. It was 5 minutes to midnight. 24. Leaving the house was so easy that Winnie felt faintly shocked. She had half expected that the instant she put a foot on the stairs, they would leap from their beds and surround her with accusations. But no one stirred. And she was struck by the realization that if she chose, she could slip out night after night without their knowing. The thought made her feel more guilty than ever that she should once more take advantage of their trust. But tonight, this one last time, she had to. There was no other way. She opened the door and slipped out into the heavy August night. Leaving the cottage was like leaving something real and moving into dream. Her body felt weightless, and she seemed to float down the path to the gate. Jesse was there, waiting. Neither of them spoke. He took her hand, and they ran together lightly down the road, past other sleeping cottages, into the dim and empty center of the village. The big glass windows here were lidded eyes that didn't care, that barely saw them, barely gave them back reflections. The blacksmith's shop, the mill, the church, the stores, so busy and alive in daylight, were hunched, deserted now, dark piles and shapes without a purpose or a meaning. And then ahead, Winnie saw the jailhouse, its new wood still unpainted, lamplight spilling through a window at the front, and there, in the cleared yard behind it, like a great L upside down, was the gallows. The sky flashed white. But this time it wasn't heat lightning, for a few moments later, a low mumble, still far away, announced at last the coming storm. A fresh breeze lifted Winnie's hair, and from somewhere in the village behind them, a dog barked. Two shadows detached themselves from the gloom as Winnie and Jesse came up. Tuck pulled her to him and hugged her hard, and Miles squeezed her hand. No one said a word. Then the four of them crept to the back of the building. Here, too high for Winnie to see into, was a barred window through which, from the room in front, light glowed faintly. Winnie peered up at it, at the blackness of the bars, with the dim gold of the light between. Into her head came lines from an old poem. Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. Over and over the lines repeated themselves in her head till they were altogether meaningless. Another roll of thunder sounded. The storm was moving nearer. Then Miles was standing on a box. He was pouring oil around the frame of the window. A swirl of wind brought the thick, rich smell of it down to Winnie's nostrils. Tuck handed up a tool, and Miles began to pry at the nails securing the window frame. Miles knew carpentering. Miles could do the job. Winnie shivered and held tight to Jesse's hand. One nail was free. Another. Tuck reached up to receive them as they came out one by one. A fourth nail screeched as it was pried up, and Miles poured on more oil. From the front of the jailhouse, the constable yawned noisily and began to whistle. The whistling came nearer. Miles dropped down. They heard the constable's footsteps coming up to May's cell. The barred door clanked. Then the footsteps receded. The whistling grew fainter. An inner door shut, and the lamp glow disappeared. At once, Miles was up again and prying at the nails. An eighth was out, a ninth, a tenth. Winnie counted carefully, while behind her counting, her mind sang, "Stone walls do not a prison make." Miles handed down the prying tool. He grasped the bars of the window firmly, ready to pull, and stood poised. "What is he waiting for?" thought Winnie. "Why doesn't he?" Then, a flash of lightning, and soon after, a crack of thunder. In the midst of the noise, Miles gave a mighty heave. But the window did not budge. The thunder ebbed. Winnie's heart sank. What if it was all impossible? What if the window would never come out? What if... She looked over her shoulder at the dark shape of the gallows and shuddered. Again a flash of lightning, and this time a crashing burst of noise from the swirling sky. Miles yanked. The window frame sprang free. And still grasping it by the bars, he tumbled backward off the box. The job was done. Two arms appeared in the hole left by the missing frame. May! Her head appeared. It was too dark to see her face. The window! What if it was too small for her to squeeze through? What if? But now her shoulders were out. She groaned softly. Another flash of lightning lit her face for an instant, and Winnie saw an expression there of deep concentration, tip of tongue protruding, brows furrowed. Now Tuck was on the box, helping her, giving her his own shoulders to pull on, Miles and Jesse close at his sides, arms upstretched, eager to receive her bulk. Her hips were free. Now, look out! Here she came, her skirts tearing on the rough edges of the boards, arms flailing, and they were all in a heap on the ground. Another crash of thunder muffled Jesse's bursting, exultant laugh. May was free! Winnie clasped her trembling hands thankfully, and then the first drop of rain plopped precisely on the tip of her nose. The Tucks untangled themselves and turned to her. One by one, as the rain began, they drew her to them and kissed her. One by one, she kissed them back. Was it rain on May's face, on Tuck's, or was it tears? Jesse was last. He put his arms around her and hugged her tight and whispered the single word, "Remember." Then Miles was on the box again, lifting her. Her hands grasped the edges of the window. This time, she waited with him. When the thunder came, it tore the sky apart with its roar, and as it came, she pulled herself through and dropped to the cot inside unharmed. She looked up at the open square and saw the frame with Miles' hands holding it. The next obliging roll of thunder saw it wedged once more into place. And then, would Miles put back the nails? She waited. Rain came in sheets now, riding the wind, flung crosswise through the night. Lightning crackled, a brilliant jagged streak, and thunder rattled the little building. The tension in the parched earth eased and vanished. Winnie felt it go. The muscles of her stomach loosened, and all at once, she was exhausted. Still, she waited. Would Miles put back the nails? At last, standing tiptoe on the cot, she grasped the bars of the window, pulling herself up till she could just see through. Rain blew into her face, but at the next flash of lightning, looking down, she saw that the yard was empty. And before the thunder followed in a pause, while wind and rain held back for one brief moment, she thought she heard, fading in the distance, the tinkling little melody of the music box. The tucks, her darling tucks, were gone. 25. The first week of August was long over, and now, though autumn was still some weeks away, there was a feeling that the year had begun its downward arc, that the wheel was turning again, slowly now, but soon to go faster, turning once more in its changeless sweep of change. Winnie, standing at the fence in front of the touch-me-not cottage, could hear the new note in the voices of the birds. Whole clouds of them lifted, chattering, into the sky above the wood, and then settled only to lift again. Across the road, goldenrod was coming into bloom, and an early drying milkweed had opened its rough pod, exposing a host of downy-headed seeds. As she watched, one of these detached itself into a sudden breeze and sailed sedately off, while others leaned from the pod as if to observe its departure. Winnie dropped down cross-legged on the grass. 2 weeks had gone by since the night of the storm, the night of May Tuck's escape, and May had not been found. There was no trace of her at all, or of Tuck, or Miles, or Jesse. Winnie was profoundly grateful for that. But she was also profoundly tired. It had been a trying 2 weeks. For the 100th time, she reviewed it all. How the constable had come into the cell soon after she had settled herself on the cot. How he had let down a shutter over the window to keep out the rain. How then he had stood over her as she hunched under the blanket, her breath heavy, trying to look as large as possible. How finally he had gone away and not come back till morning. But she had not dared to sleep, for fear she would kick off the blanket and give herself away, give the tucks away unwittingly. So she had lain there, pulse thudding, eyes wide open. She would never forget the rattle of the rain on the jailhouse roof, or the smell of wet wood, or the darkness that had saved them all, or how difficult it was not to cough. She had wanted to cough as soon as it occurred to her that she mustn't, and she passed a long hour trying to swallow away the tickle that perversely constricted her throat. And she would never forget the crash outside that made her heart race, that she could not investigate and did not understand till morning, when on the way home she saw that the gallows had blown over in the wind. But oh, it made her tremble still to remember the constable's face when he found her. She had heard first a bustling in the front of the jail and smelled fresh coffee, and had sat up stiff with apprehension. Then the inner door opened, the door she now saw, which separated the office from the pair of cells, and in the light that streamed before him, the constable appeared carrying a breakfast tray. He was whistling cheerfully. He came up to the barred door of her cell and looked in, and his whistling died on his lips as if it had run down and needed to be wound up again. But this comical astonishment lasted for a moment only, and then his face flushed red with anger. Winnie had sat on the cot, eyes downcast, feeling very small and very like a criminal. In fact, he was soon shouting that if she were older, he'd have to keep her there, that it was a crime what she had done. She was an accomplice. She had helped a murderer escape. She was, in fact, a criminal, but too young to be punished by the law. Worse luck, he told her, for she badly needed punishing. She was released, then, into the custody of her mother and father. And these new words, accomplice and custody, chilled her blood. Over and over they asked her, shocked at first and then wistful, why had she done such a thing? Why? She was their daughter. They had trusted her. They had tried to bring her up properly, with a true sense of right and wrong. They did not understand. And finally, she had sobbed the only truth there was into her mother's shoulder, the only explanation. The Tucks were her friends. She had done it because, in spite of everything, she loved them. This, of all things, her family understood, and afterward they drew together staunchly around her. It was hard for them in the village. Winnie knew it was, and the knowledge gave her pain, for they were proud, and she had shamed them. Still, this side of the affair was not without its benefits, at least for Winnie. Though she was confined to the yard indefinitely and could go nowhere, not even with her mother or her grandmother, the other children wandered by to look at her, to talk to her through the fence. They were impressed by what she had done. She was a figure of romance to them now, where before she had been too neat, too prissy, almost somehow too clean to be a real friend. Winnie sighed and plucked at the grass around her ankles. School would open soon. It wouldn't be so bad. In fact, she thought as her spirits lifted, this year it might be rather nice. And then two things happened. First of all, the toad appeared out of the weeds on her side of the road this time. It bounced out of a cover of old dandelion leaves and landed plop, just beyond the fence. If she had reached her hand through the bars, she could have touched it. And next, a large brown dog with easy gait and dangling tongue came loping down the road toward them. He stopped opposite the fence and looked at Winnie with a friendly swish of his tail, and then he saw the toad. At once he began to bark, his eyes bright. He pranced up, his hindquarters leaping independently from side to side, nose close to the toad, his voice shrill with enthusiasm. "Don't!" cried Winnie, leaping to her feet and flapping her arms. "Go away, dog! Stop that! Go away! Shoo!" The dog paused. He looked up at Winnie's frantic dancing, and then he looked at the toad, who had pressed down close to the dirt, eyes tight shut. It was too much for him. He began to bark again and reached out a long paw. "Oh!" cried Winnie. "Oh! Don't do that! Leave my toad alone!" And before she had time to realize what she was doing, she bent, reached through the bars, and snatched the toad up and away from harm, dropping it on the grass inside the fence. A feeling of revulsion swept through her.
While the dog whined, pawing uselessly at the fence, she stood rigid, staring at the toad, wiping her hand again and again on the skirt of her dress. Then she remembered the actual feel of the toad, and the revulsion passed. She knelt and touched the skin of its back. It was rough and soft, both at once, and cool. Winnie stood up and looked at the dog. He was waiting outside the fence, his head on one side, peering at her longingly. "It's my toad," Winnie told him. "So you'd better leave it alone." And then, on an impulse, she turned and ran into the cottage, up to her room, to the bureau drawer where she had hidden Jessie's bottle, the bottle of water from the spring. In a moment she was back again. The toad still squatted where she had dropped it. The dog still waited at the fence. Winnie pulled out the cork from the mouth of the bottle, and, kneeling, she poured the precious water very slowly and carefully over the toad. The dog watched this operation, and then, yawning, he was suddenly bored. He turned and loped away, back down the road to the village. Winnie picked up the toad and held it for a long time, without the least disgust, in the palm of her hand. It sat calmly, blinking, and the water glistened on its back. The little bottle was empty now. It lay on the grass at Winnie's feet. But if all of it was true, there was more water in the wood. There was plenty more, just in case, when she was 17. If she should decide, there was more water in the wood. Winnie smiled. Then she stooped and put her hand through the fence and set the toad free. "There," she said, "you're safe. Forever." Epilogue. The sign said, "Welcome to Tree Gap." But it was hard to believe that this was really Tree Gap. The main street hadn't changed so very much, but there were many other streets now crossing the main street. The road itself was blacktopped. There was a white line painted down its center. May and Tuck, on the seat of a clattering wooden wagon, bumped slowly into Tree Gap behind the fat old horse. They had seen continuous change and were accustomed to it. But here, it seemed shocking and sad.
"Look," said Tuck. "Look, May. Ain't that where the wood used to be? It's gone. Not a stick or a stump left. And her cottage. That's gone, too."
It was very hard to recognize anything, but from the little hill, which had once lain outside the village and was now very much a part of it, they thought they could figure things out.
"Yes," said May, "that's where it was, I do believe. Course it's been so long since we was here, I can't tell for certain."
There was a gas station there now. A young man in greasy coveralls was polishing the windshield of a wide and rusty Hudson automobile. As May and Tuck rolled past, the young man grinned and said to the driver of the Hudson, who lounged at the wheel,
"Looky there, in from the country for a big time,"
and they chuckled together. May and Tuck clattered on into the village proper, past a Catholic mixture of houses, which soon gave way to shops and other places of business, a hot dog stand, a dry cleaner, a pharmacy, a 5 and 10, another gas station, a tall white frame building with a pleasant veranda, the Tree Gap Hotel, family dining, easy rates, the post office, beyond that, the jailhouse, but a larger jailhouse now, painted brown with an office for the county clerk.
A black and white police car was parked in front with a red glass searchlight on its roof and a radio antenna like a buggy whip fastened to the windshield. May glanced at the jailhouse but looked away quickly. "See beyond there?" she said, pointing. "That diner? Let's stop there and get a cup of coffee, all right?"
"All right," said Tuck. "Maybe they'll know something."
Inside, the diner gleamed with chrome and smelled like linoleum and ketchup. May and Tuck took seats on rumbling swivel stools at the long counter. The counterman emerged from the kitchen at the rear and sized them up expertly. They looked all right. A little queer, maybe. Their clothes especially. But honest. He slapped a cardboard menu down in front of them and leaned on the foaming orange aid cooler.
"You folks from off?" he asked.
"Yep," said Tuck. "Just passing through."
"Sure," said the counterman.
"Say," said Tuck cautiously, fingering the menu, "didn't there used to be a wood once down the other side of town?"
"Sure," said the counterman. "Had a big electrical storm, though, about 3 years ago now or thereabouts. Big tree got hit by lightning, split right down the middle, caught fire and everything, tore up the ground, too. Had the bulldozer all out."
"Oh," said Tuck. He and May exchanged glances.
"Coffee, please," said May. "Black, for both of us."
"Sure," said the counterman. He took the menu away, poured coffee into thick pottery mugs, and leaned again on the orangeade cooler. "Used to be a fresh water spring in that wood," said Tuck boldly, sipping his coffee.
"Don't know nothing about that," said the counterman. "Had the bulldozer all out, like I say."
"Oh," said Tuck.
Afterward, while May was shopping for supplies, Tuck went back through the town on foot, back the way they had come, out to the little hill. There were houses there now, and a feed and grain store. But on the far side of the hill, inside a rambling iron fence, was a cemetery. Tuck's heart quickened. He had noticed the cemetery on the way in. May had seen it too. They had not spoken about it. But both knew it might hold other answers. Tuck straightened his old jacket. He passed through an archway of wrought iron curlicues and paused, squinting at the weedy rows of gravestones. And then, far over to the right, he saw a tall monument, once no doubt imposing, but now tipped slightly sidewise. On it was carved one name, Foster. Slowly, Tuck turned his footsteps toward the monument and saw, as he approached, that there were other, smaller markers all around it, a family plot. And then his throat closed, for it was there. He had wanted it to be there, but now that he saw it, he was overcome with sadness. He knelt and read the inscription. "In loving memory, Winifred Foster Jackson, dear wife, dear mother, 1870-1948. "So," said Tuck to himself, "2 years. She's been gone 2 years. He stood up and looked around, embarrassed, trying to clear the lump from his throat. But there was no one to see him. The cemetery was very quiet. In the branches of a willow behind him, a red-winged blackbird chirped. Tuck wiped his eyes hastily. Then he straightened his jacket again and drew up his hand in a brief salute. "Good girl," he said aloud. And then he turned and left the cemetery, walking quickly. Later, as he and May rolled out of Tree Gap, May said softly, without looking at him,
She's gone?
Tuck nodded. She's gone, he answered. There was a long moment of silence between them, and then May said,
Poor Jesse.
He knowed it, though, said Tuck. At least he knowed she wasn't coming. We all knowed that long time ago.
Just the same, said May.
She sighed, and then she sat up a little straighter.
Well, where to now, Tuck? No need to come back here no more.
That's so, said Tuck. Let's just head on out this way. We'll locate something.
All right, said May.
And then she put a hand on his arm and pointed.
Look out for that toad!
Tuck had seen it too. He reined in the horse and climbed down from the wagon. The toad was squatting in the middle of the road, quite unconcerned. In the other lane, a pickup truck rattled by, and against the breeze it made, the toad shut its eyes tightly. But it did not move. Tuck waited till the truck had passed, and then he picked up the toad and carried it to the weeds along the road's edge.
Dern fool thing must think it's going to live forever, he said to May.
And soon they were rolling on again, leaving Tree Gap behind. And as they went, the tinkling little melody of a music box drifted out behind them and was lost at last far down the road.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged listening library production. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1975 by Natalie Babbitt. Production copyright 1995, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment. It's a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary and improve their reading skills. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways you can help ensure a lifelong love of literature and reading for the children you care about. If you would like more information about audiobooks, please visit our website at www.listeninglibrary.com. Thank you.